Hello, everybody. It's Tom, and I'm here today with the inimitable James Tunney. This conversation, we're following up a little bit on a conversation I had with Doug Lane a few weeks ago about relationship between the left and the right, polarity between those terms politically, the sort of historical root of that cleavage or that split. But James has a bit of a different approach to that than what was displayed in the conversation with Doug. So, James, I don't know if you want to just go ahead and just jump into the deep end and maybe give us a sketch of your orientation with respect to the tensions between the left and the right politically, the origin, and so forth. And then, of course, as is going to be forthcoming anyway, the relationship between that division and the issues of Scientocracy and so forth.
Yes, yeah, it just made me think when I heard your conversation about the reality of this dichotomy and the extent to which we have a the extent to which
to which
this distinction is
distinction
of explanatory function. I'm going to try these things, Tom. See,
is
because I'm getting feedback there. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. You do sound distant.
I'll carry on. The whether the left-right distinction is of ex explanatory function anymore, and whether in the context of Scientocracy we have to reevaluate the assumptions on which we've had debates for the last 100 years. And I'm very skeptical about the utility of the left-right distinction. So, in particular, I would cast our minds back to the early part of the 20th century. And one book that comes to mind is The Man Who Was Thursday by G.K. Chesterton. And in that book, which is an important book, the person joined as an undercover policeman, joining undercover or secret anarchists, finds that virtually all the other anarchists are secret policemen too. And I think that this is a profound metaphor of the difficulty we have in relation to distinguishing the motivation and political tactics and strategies of people in complex organizations. And in particular, when we consider things like, say, policies after Gramsci and in Trotskyism or entryism, we see that people can appear to be one thing and represent a different political view. And then when we come to the issue of predictability, we see that the utility of a presumed political position doesn't match with the reality that we may expect. This is evident recently in relation to some of the left-wing views on joining NATO in Europe, that some of the people we would have expected to be against NATO now all of a sudden are in favor of NATO. It's not a thing that was very predictable from the things that they had said beforehand. And we begin to find that the predictive powers of compartmentalization in particular categories don't work anymore. Now, my suggestion is that the reason why they don't work anymore is because we may be misinterpreting what's happening in the political scene. That's one thing. But overriding that, and in conjunction with that, is the fact that the movement towards Scientocracy can make use of the left and the right, and both will further its aims. So, as Deng Xiaoping said, it doesn't matter whether we use a black cat or a white cat to catch the mouse, they will still perform that function. So, what I want to suggest is that I think we're misinterpreting what's happening in the world by focusing on this left-right distinction. If we look at the origin of well, Bolshevism, for example, and particularly in its London phase, or Trotskyism in the United States phase before they go to back for the Russian Revolution. We see that there was a lot more complex range of relationships that are not easily answered in terms of left-right. So what I suggest is that the policy as advocated by H.G. Wells in relation to attaining the New World Order represents a fusion of left and right, and that both left and right can be used to further the aim of achieving a Scientocracy, and that really the distinction is not much use in relation to that overall objective. That would be kind of an opening statement.
I was listening. Apologies, I'm somewhat distracted because I was trying to fix an audio issue on my side. So apologies on that count. But I do think that to fixate on the or to focus upon the limitations of the left-right distinction constitutes a sort of deep insight. I think the way I apprehended the issue when I was talking with Douglas Lane and when I talk about the issue more generally is that often the notion of the left is associated with mere liberalism, as opposed to what I would say is a more radical characterization, where one sort of rejects fundamentally certain structures which are allowed within a liberal narrative, whether that is with respect to the state or so forth, right? But here, what you're noting is that even though historically that might have some purchase, ultimately we're at a junction where the distinction between sort of a soft left or liberal left and more, you know, hardcore communist or anarchist left is almost immaterial, because the rhetorical function of the distinction is no longer, but it's a rhetorical distinction and not a philosophically substantive distinction, deployed essentially for propagandistic function or purpose. Would that be roughly what you're saying?
Yes, that's part of it. If we think back in relation to the left-right approach in relation to the COVID crisis, we see that people that on the left, for example, that you may have expect to have a particular view, end up in the same position as people on the right. So, for example, you listen to Chomsky and you say, okay, it's interesting to hear what he's going to say. He's aware of these big commercial enterprises. He's aware of big corporations. He's aware of corporate interest. He's aware of the propaganda model. Let's hear what he says. And then he says, well, you know, effectively that people that don't want to get vaccinated should stay at home. And if they starve, it's their problem. It was quite incredible. At the same time, we have someone who I presume is on the right, Donald Trump, and we have his supporters, the man of the people, and he goes to his rally and says, you know, I'm going to bring in the military for the vaccine. And you say, hold on a second. These two people are articulating the same principle. And of course, it's useful if you have a germaphobe for your president at a time when you have one of these pandemics, etc., that someone's going to be convinced of that policy. And even then, what began to bug me was when I looking at what people were saying. Well, it wasn't the only thing that bugged me. And you take another person that might be seen to be in the stream of capitalism, a popular figure, Conor McGregor in Ireland. So here's a guy, a rags to riches MMA star that becomes the biggest superstar in the world in sports terms. You know, with all the bling and all the celebration of material success. So all of a sudden, this person is, you know, advertising about the necessity to help with this public health crisis and talking about the importance of And you say, well, hold on a second. And even in those two figures, it's interesting that nobody has made the comparison, the remarkable parallels between the rise of Conor McGregor and the rise of Donald Trump, both people with Scots-Irish background, both people kind of ginger appearance, both people who are brash, materialistic. It's kind of a remarkable parallel story. And these two people managed to speak to big constituencies in the propaganda model to tell them why this was okay, you know. So whether we look at the left or the right in this context, when we look even, for example, at Trotskyist parties in Europe, who do articulate a standard left view, anti-NATO, etc., and purport to be in favor of the working class. And then their argument in this context seemed to be the same as Bill Gates. We need to get more vaccines to poor people. The main concern with the poor was to get these corporate things out to people in Africa. So you begin to say, well, the previous distinction doesn't matter, because ultimately in the move towards a Scientocracy, there are primary policies. Now, if the people that are supposedly kind of a left hue or a right hue are in agreement about the same policies, we have to be concerned. Now, there has been a recent tendency to describe this movement of the far left and far right as a kind of horseshoe, as a, you know, the idea that they're tending towards the center. I don't think it's of much use, because, you know, the suggestion of a horseshoe is that it ends there and they don't go any further. They just tend towards. My image would be of a pincer movement, that actually both left and right, insofar as they're based on a militant materialist foundation, will tend towards this technocracy, technotronic society, and will tend towards global governance by technology, both from a left perspective and a right perspective. So they are moving in the same direction. That is, therefore, we can have movement quite easily between the different groups on the, you know, on the alleged horseshoe, but they're actually on the same place. And where I began to get suspicious about some of this was when I looked at the time of the Iraq War, which is very important in relation to me getting more committed or articulating my views, was that a lot of the people that were in favor of the wars of aggression had come from left-wing backgrounds, from Trotskyist backgrounds, for example. And George Galloway, who has been consistently anti-war in the Middle East, he said, well, I remember giving out leaflets, you know, communist leaflets with these, or seeing him giving out leaflets. These were cabinet ministers you're talking about, you know, on Marxism, you know, in the 60s. And now they're advocating for the complete opposite. And this is a strange phenomenon. Even in people that were in the Reagan government, you see, they came from a left-wing background. Now you say, well, how has that happened? Did they just go through a conversion? Well, arguably, both from a certain Marxist analysis and a capitalist analysis leads to the position, correctly in a way, that the global phenomenon, economic, commercial, whatever, become central, and they both become preoccupied with the same issues. And I believe that somewhere, I'm not sure exactly when it happened, but it was around 2000, that the left decided that it had more to gain from globalization and taking control of it and being involved in it than being outside of it. So there was a shift in the anti-globalization movement, I believe, that some of the people on the left changed their view on globalization. And I think that was based on a presumption that they could control it more. But in the end, it's the same thing. We get two movements which are predicated on a vision of the human in a materialist context, and they're tending towards this global governance situation with the centrality of scientism. And that's why I talk about the empire of scientism. The empire of scientism, as Wells explained, and that's my term, empire of scientism, can unite both these tendencies. So that's why he recommended in 1916 that corporations and the kind of the left wing could come together in these international bodies. And that's what has happened. So the point is that both the left and the right are leading us towards technocracy. The implications of both are very, very similar. As mentioned before, new myths, new worlds about the Bolsheviks and their views on Nietzsche and the impact of Nietzsche on both the Nazis and the Bolsheviks. We can find a kind of common origin for certain left-right views on the basis of a set of views based on the Enlightenment, the Protestant Reformation, the Enlightenment, and moving on towards theories of evolution, Huxley's views of the races, etc. And I'm arguing that they're leading to the same position. They're not struggling against each other in the same way, which leads people open to manipulation, to serving a cause that's actually not what they believe they're serving, ultimately ending in this scientocratic view. Now, again, Bernal explained this view in his book, The World, the Flesh and the Devil, by saying that scientific corporations would, now he was a Stalinist, scientific corporations would take over the world by stealth. So the idea that corporations are capitalist and that the left will have nothing to do with corporations doesn't hold anymore. That there's many people on the left that understand they can achieve their objectives through corporations. The Chinese Communist Party is a corporate organization. They use corporations in a capitalist context to achieve their objectives. This distinction is illusory anymore. And then when we look at BlackRock, who seem to be getting ready to introduce a new digital currency, they enforce economic, social, and governance goals on companies. So the corporations, if they are wanting to maintain in a classic position their corporate profits and reinvest them, can also create a pseudo left, as something that that appears left but is not really left. And the dog that doesn't bark or that didn't bark. The issue that kind of reveals this is the lack of interest by Marxists in the working class of the countries they come from, and this is a thing that I've heard Swedish Marxists talking about. Well, why are we not interested in the working class in our country? And if we go back to, say, James Connolly, I don't know if you know much about James Connolly, but he was a very important Irish socialist. He took part in the revolution in 1916. He was essentially a Marxist, but he could reconcile, for example, socialism and Catholicism. He thought there were different domains. This is a different thing, a different view from today. He also believed that the national base was critical in relation to establishing the protection of the working class. He said that Ireland without the Irish people means nothing to me. This is not a view that's held by his successors. But his take on socialism, if you like, communism, was utterly different than what we have now. And he wouldn't, on his terms, I don't think he would support many of the movements. What has happened, I believe, is that the influence of Gramsci in particular has led people on the left to believe that anything which is counter-hegemonic is in their interest. And the problem with that is that this is what the New World Order doctrine espouses. They say we need to destroy religion, the nation state, and the family. So if you come from a kind of Gramscian perspective, you can be sold an idea or you can believe that your destruction of the hegemonies there is serving the interest of some notional future working class or some unworking class living in some luxury digital state. But really you're serving the purposes of this scientocracy. And I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's the black cat or white cat. So I can't see any coherent left-right relevant distinction anymore in this. We're talking about really forces that are moving towards the technocracy, totalitarianism, and some vague class of people that are not organized, not clear about what's going on, but are reluctant about that movement.
I I think James Connolly is an apt figure to invoke. And when you brought him up, and this, I'm going to have another conversation with another chap, W.D. James, is his nom de plume. And he's trying to remedy the impression that if someone is critical of modernity, they are then reactionary. That's the perspective that you, if you're critical of the project of modernity, science, technology, etc., in your terms, scientism or scientocracy, then somehow you are regenerate in your perspective. And he wants to counter that. I bring that sort of issue up in connection with Connolly because his socialism, which is often conceived to be an essentially contemporary movement, was wedded to his theological commitments, or the Catholic tradition of social justice, which is deep and long running. And no one who's familiar with Connolly or those of his ilk, like Dorothy Day or on this side of the pond or other sort of more strident Catholics grounded in the social justice position, can really reasonably suggest these people are reactionary. It's rather that their sense of social justice is grounded in some relationship with the transcendent. And so what is the question to which I'm driving here? I guess the question to which I'm driving here is, or one question might be, in making that connection in response to what you were saying about Connolly, am I tracking you? Am I following you correctly?
Yes, there's debate about the extent to which he was genuinely Catholic, but I mean, I think that's, I think there's enough evidence, and I think you're right, there was a contiguity with Catholic social thinking that actually John Paul was moving into that domain. If they had listened to Connolly earlier on, they may have been better. They couldn't at the stage that John Paul was looking at the connection. There was different forces in operation, and a significant figure here is actually Malachy Martin, and he's a neglected figure in relation to international relations. Now his argument is important in this thing. He's known as an exorcist, as a person who was, you know, talking about the Fatima secrets, a person who said that satanic masses had occurred in just outside the Vatican walls, who wrote novels about this. But his work, if you look at his novels and his works of nonfiction and his pronouncement, he was a very intelligent man. Now, he argued that the Catholic Church was being taken over by Marxism. He was quite clear on this, that a lot of an argument that took me. I began to study it after he did it, and I began to look at the arguments in its favor, the extent to which there was evidence there. And you do have very interesting takeovers of the churches in Europe, Protestant churches in the 60s. That is quite well documented. If you look, for example, at a number of Protestant churches in Europe, they don't believe in God. The vast majority of the people don't believe in God, which is quite strange. They're political systems. And I think that's quite well established, particularly in relation to the Swedish church, for example. That's a strange kind of view, but that's actually an important one. So he believes that John Paul II made a mistake, that what he was trying to do was to reconcile the remaining Marxism that had come from with the fall of the Soviet Union with Catholicism, and that he allowed an influence, too big of an influence, of Marxism on the church. Now, this is in stark contrast to his views on liberation theology in South America that John Paul was against. But Malachy Martin believed that he made a strategic error in relation to his accommodation of Marxism in Europe. And he has a different take on from being in the Vatican of what happened. He didn't believe that, for example, this idea of a parallel society grown in Czechoslovakia and Poland. He didn't believe in that at all. He believed there was a central change of policy from Moscow, and that his idea of a parallel society, and that is not true. I know a lot of people believe this can work in the future. But Connolly said that when you go to the altar, it has nothing got to do with socialism, and that the only thing that socialism is doing, or the premise, is that there may be an afterlife. That's not a thing for socialism to have a view on. But if we're going to go to an afterlife, it's better that we don't live on a hell on earth before we go on. And that was, I think, the best statement he made in relation to the distinction between the material world and the spiritual world. But I got an email from a Palestinian chap, and he asked me, he said, is the things going, and I don't want to go off on this tangent, but just, he said, is the question he asked me was, do you think that what's happening in relation to Israel and Palestine now is associated with what I call the globe tech government, or the movement towards global technological government? And I said, that's a complex one to answer. But if I'm right that the empire of scientism is the dominant force, I would refer you back to history, and history is the best learning trajectory. That if you took an imperial administrator from Britain, who was in office from the 1830s to 1850s, and you showed him the strategic context, or the hotspots, he would recognize them immediately. So, for example, Afghanistan, we had the British Empire fighting the wars in Afghanistan in the early 19th century. Crimea, there was 30,000 Irish men, fought in the Crimean War in 1854, 30,000 Irish people. So this connection with Ukraine is not new, but most people don't remember that. And of course, in the 1830s, the British Empire became very interested in Palestine. And of course, this is all in the context of a struggle between the Russian Empire and the British Empire, and a struggle to get communications through the Middle East and to the East. So those struggles are going on in their present form for at least 200 years. And of course, we go back to Palestine, to the Templar states, and going back 1,000 years. So the idea that they're answerable or analyzable in terms of recent phenomena requires a type of Alzheimer's in order to a disregard of the history, an idea that we're living in a moment in order to interpret them. It was a similar thing in relation to Ireland. Most of my English friends said, oh, why are those people fighting about religion all the time? And I said, well, it's not actually fundamentally a religious issue. It's a colonial issue. It always has been. It wasn't a religious issue when the Catholics came to the Catholic country. It became articulated in those terms. So the point would be that really we have a continuity of colonial interests that are manifesting itself, which I agree with Chomsky in relation to his analysis of Ukraine. But then I find it difficult to understand, well, why does he not see in all his analysis about this military-industrial complex that we're facing the exact same thing, achieving objectives that the Fabian socialist, the wolf in sheep's clothing, people told us that was going to happen, about a focus on evolution, a focus on changing humanity, a kind of hatred of overpopulation, and a kind of misanthropy. So what I think is going to happen, my prediction, unfortunately, is that we may get to the situation that Stalin actually wanted, when Stalin said at a particular time that the Soviet Union and the Nazis working together would be unbeatable. That when we get the worst of the left and the worst of the right together in a scientocracy, we have all the conditions for the great assault on humanity, because that's at base the problem. The foundation of this is about this materialist and this dominating materialist ideology of the human. And once you start off with that, it can never go anywhere good. And this is the essential difficulty, that they both share that militant materialism that might manifest itself in a Richard Dawkins, or might manifest itself in a Conor McGregor. It doesn't matter when it becomes like, well, I won't accuse him of the same thing, because he's not that politically involved. But you know what I mean? That a certain part of the attitude. Okay, sir.
No, guys. I'm amused. I'm sure. I take it. I kind of derived a little schadenfreude from contemplating how Richard Dawkins would take being compared to Conor McGregor, which I don't think he would necessarily receive that as a complimentary analogy. Not being a fan of Mr. Dawkins. But that sort of humor to the side. I think with respect to Chomsky, you know, he is kind of a curious figure, especially now in his advanced years. He has departed from some of his historical commitments in almost a bizarre way. And for example, he's associated now, I think, with some effort to sort of control disinformation that has become associated actively with censorship. How he can square that circle, I don't know, but I suspect a clue resides in his own sort of secular commitments. That once you are seeing the world in that truncated way, there's a manner which does not have the refuge of some sort of transcendent, you end up in some rather odd cul-de-sacs. Of course, I have to be very careful how I put that, because it does seem conceivable to arrive at a similar set of positions as, say, those of, you know, whether it's the Catholic social justice movement or elsewhere, without being a theist per se. I can think of someone like Camus, for instance, who was at least nominally an atheist, but whose own politics essentially, not all points, but broadly sort of square with my own intuitions. So my criticisms of, as you said, militant materialism notwithstanding, I don't want those to be used to suggest that we're ruling out altogether the viability of someone arriving at similar ethical or political positions without the same metaphysics as what we're using right now.
I accept that. Yeah.
But this is sort of a different question, and I wonder what you think, as long as we've sort of raised the issue of what's going on in Israel-Palestine and noting the sort of deeper history of that conflict and its relationship to imperial projects more broadly. There is the symbolic and perhaps even sort of spiritual significance of Jerusalem and that land. And I'm wondering, do you think that plays into the designs of the imperialist and or scientocratic project in a way which is not explicitly acknowledged?
Oh yeah, there's no question about it. The New World Order, remember, the implication is that it will have some particular basis. You can see this happening already. At the weekend, there's going to be a fight between the world heavyweight boxing champion Tyson Fury and Francis Ngannou in Saudi Arabia. There's a movement of entertainment, of interest to the Middle East, which reflects what happened with the City of London when it began to, after the colonial movement happened, it began to diversify and spread its wealth, its basis to other places in the Caribbean, in the Middle East. But this is so we have a movement back to play, you know, Abu Dhabi and Dubai and Saudi Arabia, strangely as a movement, but this is also a movement back to the perceived origins of the classes, which Malachy Martin described. He described a red internationale and a golden internationale. And they were both, again, representative of two forces towards globalization. So the global internationale, or international, he described as a kind of complex of rich families, of wealthy capitalists, etc., who interacted through networks. And a lot of them are very interested in the Middle East. So what the New World Order is going to do, or what, according to Wells, is to retake places like Basra and places in that part of the world as strategic important nodes to control the connection between East and West and North and South. So it's strange when they begin to come up in the context of the Iran-Iraq war. They've always been interested in recovering Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is seen in many esoteric viewpoints, religious viewpoints, as the kind of omphalos of the world, the navel of the world. And it's important, if you want to control a new world order, to control these key points. But of course, it's a strategic crossroads, it always has been. And remember, there's trade between Britain and that part for well before the time of Christ, going from Britain to that area in silver and tin and things like that. So Rome is the other place they have to get back or to take over, because this is a fundamentally important part, going back to the Roman Empire, etc. So we have that strange affinity that was manifest in the description of Keynes about Isaac Newton being the last of the magicians, going back to that era. We see it in Arthur C. Clarke, going back to Babylon. So there's a recovery. So one is that strange esoteric recovery of that part, the Garden of Eden, the control of the world, the real symbology. And it's consistent. A number of the people that fought for Irish independence did so when they were out in places like Mesopotamia and saying, well, what are we doing out fighting over here? Same stuff again, that this recovery, this recovery of the world. But it's utility for the Scientocracy is critical. And if you look back at all the wars that the United States government has engaged in the Middle East, they always utilize this this view of the Book of Revelation. So here we go again, this is predicted. They have utilized that. They have utilized that, in particular from the 1830s. They realized, and I believe that this is what explains the rapture movement. I've talked about that elsewhere. Dispensationalism, I believe, essentially came from the British Empire. A lot of people will find that difficult, but there's millions of people now in the United States, tens of millions. It's quite incredible. Christians who are waiting to be taken up because the rapture is happening, because this is what has anticipated. So every time you want to engage militarily in the Middle East, you activate this constituency. Here we go again. Start quoting from Christian source, allegedly, particularly from a Protestant tradition. So it's very strategically useful to be able to do that. Now, I believe, in many senses, if you look at the origin of Israel and that really, it's an imperial use of the Jewish history in this context, and that it is more describable in terms of British imperial policy than anything else. And this, remembering how young the state is, my father was born in 1918. So this is not a long historical context we're talking about. And he was asked one time to join the Palestinian police force. People forget about the British involvement in this in there and how close it is. So why it's so useful now is you can activate the Protestant constituency that believe in the rapture in the United States, and you can get them into a state of frenzy by utilizing John Nelson Darby's theories, and by saying, okay, this is a sure sign. All that propaganda that had, you know, about the rapture, about being taken away, a lot of people really believe it in the States. I couldn't believe how many people have fallen for that. It's not about the Christian beliefs, about this particular doctrine.
You may know more about this, but I also have the impression, correlatively, that the British were intimately connected with the rise of Islamic fundamentalism and Wahhabism and so forth, right? That the Muslim Brotherhood and so forth were sort of actively cultivated, encouraged, and so on by the British.
Absolutely, yeah. Well,
so, I mean, it's just another aspect of the question.
If you wanted to analyze it in the terms that I'm putting forward as a hypothesis, it makes perfect sense. You were talking about Afghanistan, and you say, well, Afghanistan doesn't make sense for the in one of the previous conversations, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, etc.
What I meant most specifically in my remark with Douglas Lane was that how the withdrawal logistically was undertaken was a disaster. And it was poorly organized from a logistical standpoint. And the consequence of that disastrous organization were, you know, a set of unnecessary casualties and so on and so forth. So my remark was not intended to refer specifically to whether or not the Americans should have withdrawn from Afghanistan. It was the concrete manner of the withdrawal, which I found objectionable and which seemed to reflect the level of incompetence within the Democratic Party. So that's what I meant more specifically in that, and I didn't make that clear. I should have made that clearer than I did. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that it's not incompetence. That this failure was the policy, if you look at it from a different viewpoint. And one person from American foreign policy context who was very interested in Afghanistan was Brzezinski. Okay, so Brzezinski, of course, writes the Technotronic Society. So he's anticipating the movement towards this technological society, tech-totalitarianism. So he was delighted when the Russians moved in because he knew they would lose. Okay. So what one has to explain then is why the same people, the same constituency of thinkers, allows the Americans to go in. But if you're in favor of global governance, the extension of the United States beyond its stretching capacity, the extension into pointless wars, serves your purposes of movement towards global governance. It makes perfect sense in terms of if your goal is towards a scientocracy. So I don't agree with this incompetence analysis. I think this is the reason why, obviously, was there was going to be movement into other theaters that suited them, other classic imperial, you know, move to Ukraine, for example, get involved in. So there's a possibility that this was the underlying strategic objective, because what you want to, as the Tao Te Ching says, what you want to destroy, you first extend. And this is, so it makes perfect sense if you believe that if you believe in counter-hegemonic forces, and who is the great hegemon? It's the United States. Why is the United States engaged in all that? It doesn't make sense. But it does make sense if the objective is to move towards a situation where there are limited or a different classification of hegemonic forces. That's what I would say. And of course, it fits in a pattern of interference that goes back to, well, Alexander the Great or whoever you want to, but in particular in the British Empire. So there's a history of knowledge of how one gets involved in them quagmires. And again, there's plenty of Irishmen sent over there. What were they doing? What were they doing? That, you know, but why are they, it's the same question I would ask of the, you know, no disrespect to any person who serves the country. But it's not those who are criticizing. It's really the propaganda system that claims right. They're going over there for, you know, to protect
that
women.
That exploit the goodwill of men and women who join these organizations, thinking that they're, you know, serving to protect them.
And here you say, well, why would the Western forces support extremism? And it's quite clear because, for example, according to certain articles in political theory, there has been a kind of transplantation of what has been described as moderate Islamic communities with more extreme communities by Saudi Arabia, the ally in Europe, the ally of the Anglospheric forces. And you say, well, why is that? Well, if you look at the classic divide and conquer strategy, what you do want is two extremes. Now, the sad inference from that, which I believe is a real danger now, is that the reason why you would do so is if your policy is to abolish religion, to abolish the nation state, to abolish the family, well, a very convincing strategy to achieve that purpose is to get the two largest religious groups fighting each other in a massive civil war, a global civil war, to accentuate the differences between Islam and Christianity, to draw them into situations of competition in order to provoke that reality so you can come along with your technological scientistic analysis, which explains that religion is the cause of all problems. So that's the great danger with the encouragement, which they have been. There's no question about the extremization of political factors because of the involvement of the CIA and the utility, which comes into the deep state analysis as well, and the use of criminal and extreme forces by the states, which is what G.K. Chesterton was talking about in 1908. Why is there so much of the state involved in these groups where everyone in the movement who ostensibly were destroying the world were actually part of a governance claim, which is what kind of Orwell was getting at as well. And again, in that context, when we look at things like the Spanish Civil War, which people kind of forget about in a lot of the analysis, the kind of precursor of the World War, people forget about the great struggle. Great is not the correct word, between the Stalinists and the Trotskyists in that context. And this comes the last point on this. It's very interesting the way certain people that believe they're very critical of and understand what's happening, they celebrate certain figures, which you say, I can't understand how they are celebrated. For example, Christopher Hitchens, take an example, a very interesting figure and certainly a very good speaker, and a lot of people like his writing. But if you listen to Peter Hitchens, his brother, talking about him, and they had a lot of rivalry, whatever, but they came from both, again, the Trotskyist background. And they're also associated with the New Statesman in London, which is an interesting context, as was, I think, Martin Amis and that. So Peter Hitchens explains, he said, when we, in our revolutionary period, the idea was that we would wade through a sea of blood to get to our paradise. Now, I believe that viewpoint is still there. It's very, very dominant on both the left and the right. That the idea is that you can solve a number of problems in a Malthusian way, overpopulation way, a control way, all this solves a load of problems if you have a massive war, if you create tensions. And I believe that a lot of a lot of the reason why both the left and the right are interested in the move and massive movement of people. And this is the thing that doesn't make sense, for example, that in contrast with Connolly's view about the importance of the nation state and the Westphalian state, his descendants, if you like, argue for kind of mass migration, which is the exact same thing that people like the Director General of the World Trade Organization, Peter Sutherland, head of Goldman Sachs, he's dead now, but he argued for the exact same. And his argument was quite clear, and he made it before the House of Lords, that the population of the United Kingdom was too homogenous. Now, the reason why he didn't want a homogenous population, in my view, was because if you have homogenous groups, they can react to the, you know, the coming tech totalitarianism. I really believe so. The left and the right share this view of breaking down existing population. I'll give you an example, and these are contradictions that make no sense to me. I was talking to a chap who describes a very very civil conversation. I try and have civil conversations with people, but I'm curious about their viewpoints and things. And he describes himself as an anarchist. And I said, well, what about my family in Ireland? If I believe that they've been living in the same place for you know, this is in sharp contrast to his views on Palestine, I think. But if my family have been living for thousands of years in Ireland, as I believe they have they no more, a bigger claim than anybody else, from another country, to, you know, in relation to the say in that land? And he said, oh, no, they don't. You know, that would be a blood and soil argument. So what I'm thinking, and this is a young person who's really into the, what I'm thinking is, well, if you have that view, you cannot support indigenous people. You couldn't do it because their connection with their land is a critical thing. If you take that ideology and extend it, you couldn't have that viewpoint. It makes no sense to me. And a very important, I think a critical revolution that's ignored in recent revolutions is the Zapatista revolution, the Mayan Indians in 1992. And they remarkably and presciently rebelled, you know, from a left-wing perspective, a peasant perspective, referring back to Mexican history and indigenous rights. They rebelled against NAFTA. They anticipated correctly the implication of these treaties for the corn-based economy in the mountains. And they were right, and I agreed with them. But this view, this which I believe is a genuine left-wing view, which I believe Connolly and that would support, it would be challenged on the ground on the apparent policy of a lot of apparent kind of left-wing. It makes no sense to me. The inconsistencies betray a lack of awareness about the game they're involved in. It makes utter, it doesn't make any sense to.
I think the fulcrum point upon which it turns is the degree to which we have been hypnotized by abstraction. So most people who identify as on the left, especially as on the secular left, are beholden to this notion of the human being, which is, or humanity. There's like a quote, I think it's ascribed to Dostoevsky, right? The more you love humanity, the more you're going to hate human beings, right? But they idolize this notion of an abstract human being, and all abstract human beings sort of enter into these abstractly ideal relationships. This takes them out of the context of material history. And so tension which arises, for example, as to, you know, whether or not the Irish have a right to be in Ireland, doesn't make sense to them because it departs from being situated in this sort of mathematical space of orientation. That's how I would address the seeming inconsistency. And there are real tensions because on the one hand, with respect to the question of immigration, there are authentic human needs. People are being driven by terrible circumstances away from where they live, people, as a rule, don't generally choose to move to other countries. I mean, obviously there are exceptions, but when you're coming to the question of refugees, you're coming to a question of people responding to real crisis, and there is like a genuine sort of ethical exigency to help these people one way or the other. So there is an unavoidable tension. We can't pretend that can be dissolved. But in my view, the solutions, such as they are, will be derived from a sense of solidarity. The problem with the discourse, which we inherit, is that it prevents us from entering into solidarity. Because in fact, both the indigenous Irish and or the, you know, it doesn't, no matter where you situate this kind of situation, you have the same thing here in the southern border of the U.S., right? The people coming from South America and Mexico, you know, these people are not the enemy. In fact, we are mutually at the behest of a system which seeks to oppress us both. And that's I think where the solution resides is in identifying who the real villain in the piece is, as it were. You know, how does that translate into concrete policy options? Well, then that's a whole other ball of wax.
Well, just let me respond on that. My issue, it's not about emigration, and I've accepted quite a while ago that Ireland will never be Irish in any kind of cultural context that them fellas were fighting about in 1916. It will never be. It's gone. That possibility is gone. In fact, the people who describe themselves as indigenous, that's not the correct word in relation to, but in a native Irish in a historical context, the numbers are falling and will fall. And they will fall below 50% in this generation, according to government statistics. That's just the way it is. I'm a pragmatist. So I don't have any problem with that. I don't have any problem with the emigration, and I don't have any problem with, with refugees, none of that. What I do have a problem with is when massive corporate forces are creating the conditions. And this is the problem. And supporting that is the problem. For example, here's another example. Gaddafi says, they're not going to get rid of me because I'm stopping a massive flood of immigrants into Europe. If you take me out, this is why he believed he wasn't going to be eradicated. He knew they wanted to get rid of him. They wanted his oil. They didn't want his alternative policies. They didn't want him bringing in a gold currency. They didn't want him controlling the access to the underground water. They didn't want him controlling the oil resources. So he believed that that would keep him in. He presumed that the authorities in Europe didn't want this massive immigration, but they did. And that's why they got rid of him. And that's why. So it's funny enough, it's not me. When I went to America, someone was complaining to me about the experience they had when they were in the south of Italy because of all the immigrants there. And I said, but your government has created this situation. Your Democratic Party, was that incompetence? No, they were very clear about what they're doing. The Democratic Party and the military-industrial complex, they were very clear on creating those conditions. So the point is that there is a deliberate creation of unsustainable conditions that can't end well. It's not about anything got to do with immigration. It's not. I mean, this is a classic false dichotomy. Oh, you're saying this. This is a real danger about this. I'm saying that people who are ahead of the biggest corporate forces in the world wanted this immigration. What is the historical context? I've written about implantation of automaton. It's plantation. So this is a policy. So when a supposed left is supporting the conditions which create this, including the military forces, you have to ask a question about, is this consistent? And then when they don't support any working class and they don't support housing for the working class in the particular area, well, then you're going against the policies that leading socialist communists were doing, which makes one suspicious. Either they don't understand the game or they're not what they're saying they're doing. That's what my objection. So it's not, there's always a reduction to this, oh, you're for or against. I'm an immigrant here in Sweden. So, I mean, I'm not complaining about the, I understand right. that context. So, I mean, it's funny enough, really I'm not seen as an immigrant, right. You know, but I am in this context. So the idea that I don't have, or in some way, you know, one's views is oversimplified is another issue. Last point, the implication of both the left and the right is towards human evolution. So when you're talking about the idea of the human, if you look at Trotsky, for example, in his books on literature and I think literature and socialism in 24, 25, or his essays, he describes the future human and he describes a biological change in the human. So his view about the future under this great communist paradise is the same as the views from the people in the transhumanist context. So the people that are struggling supposedly for this future kind of working class human, this ideal human, whoever they will be at the moment, are struggling in favor of this theory of evolution as well. So it's not based on any idea of the human as a static. The idea is of permanent revolution. The permanent revolution is permanent revolution of your body and mind as well, of your world existence, of the thing that, and this is where Philip K. Dick was correct. He believed that the future government of the United States and elsewhere would be left fascism, a combination of both. And I think it was a fairly prescient concern of his. He understood that they could come together, that the worst, not the good bits that we could identify or positive or, right. or pro-human bits, but elements that utilize this. Last point I have to say before I forget this. Another interesting element in this spirituality dimension to it is that a lot of the New Age people really either don't understand the game that's going on they're getting involved in, or are not open players in this, or have a case to answer for. For example, Deepak Chopra was in Dublin talking, and he said, I don't have any time for politicians. The only ones I admire are Bertie Ahern, who I've come across, I know quite a bit about, and I have met him a few times and know people. And I was asked, he solicited an opinion once in relation to a particular thing, but and Jacinta Ardern, New Zealand. So,
see, there's this.
So I think the it's last like point, this. The last point.
Yeah, so sorry, go on.
The last point. So, looking at a lot of these people. They are, and he's you know, proud of his involvement in WEF, as is in Sadhguru and these people, you know, talks about reducing population. They become political players if they're not political players already. So left, right, and all, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter anymore. We have to look at what are the consequences in a classic pragmatic way, of what are the consequences of these views for the world? What paradigm, what bus are they taking? What values are they advocate? Sorry, I went on a bit there.
No, it's okay. It's, you know what it is? It's the danger of the way, you know, all right. So I think that there is a remarkable naivete in certain quarters. So you take someone like Deepak Chopra. I don't know Deepak Chopra. Okay. I believe I read one book of his many, many years ago. You know, I see him, he makes the rounds, I see him in interviews. My personal impression is that he's a genuine individual, right? But a genuine individual who suffers from a kind of really hazardous naivete, because he's associating with elements that are frankly nefarious. And I don't know if he really gets that. I really don't want to impugn him as being malicious or ill-intended. I just think he hasn't thought through the import or significance of his associations. And, you know, I'm not trying to beat up on Deepak Chopra. That's just an example that has happened to have come up in the course of this conversation.
I'm sure the man is a very nice man. I'm sure that, but you're very charitable, right, Tom. You're charitable to the Democrats in Afghanistan, say, as a competence. You're charitable in the kind of naivety. Here's the problem. Here's what I want to make out of that point. The time for being casual about if you're a public figure is gone. What I say is, yeah, in the Buddhist context as well, we must use right words. We must be very, very clear about what we're saying with nuance. And if we are led, and I'm not saying about that, good luck to the man, but you really have right to begin to take responsibility, especially if you are a public figure. Now, I would also criticize, he's heavily involved, that AI thing and that. But there's a time you have to take a stand on it. There's a time when the person,
there is a time,
you know. So and what I'm saying is that if you do, my students, when I taught them for years on, say, European law, at the end of it they say, but do you think it's good or bad? So the point was they didn't know what my political views was, because I kept my mouth shut. My objective was not to tell them some political view and to sell my views. My view was to make them skilled in the law and how it worked as a system and predictability. So I made a huge effort not to put my views. I never began to really publicly make my views known, my views, until a few years ago. And it took me a long time to come to some conclusions. So I don't shoot my mouth off or anything. And what I'm saying is, now let me make it clear. If my view is right, which I fear it is, that we're facing a dark future because of the interaction of a range of forces that are both nefarious and ill-conceived, a really dark possibility as a result of the military-industrial complex, the empire of scientism, and various other ideological forces. If we're facing that, well, then we have an obligation to be very careful about at least knowing what we're talking about, at least taking responsibility for when we make statements to be able to back it up and to take the consequences of that, to know what we are advocating. Now, I understand it's difficult. We don't know. We can make mistakes. It's difficult for people to interpret, for example, Jordan Peterson. Loads of people couldn't, what is he saying? This, is he this, is he this? Well, again, look on particular issues. When the issue, say, of the thing came out and the injections and all that kind of stuff. So the man that was so upset about the state wanting to put words in his mouth had no problem having something put into his body. It doesn't make sense. It's just inconsistent. It's utterly inconsistent. So what I'm saying is that if the people fail you on the biggest issue, which I believe is the Scientocracy issue, the toleration of the vagueness doesn't help us anymore. And this, there's a time for nuance and there's a time for clarity in relation to identification of a phenomenon. I'm not saying anything bad about the man, about Deepak Chopra, about people that like that. But really, the general point is, it's no accident that New Age came from California, which is the heaviest concentration of the military-industrial complex in the United States. That's another story. But it's not really an accident that Bolshevism came from London, that Lenin meets Trotsky in 1903 in London, in the same down the road from where H.G. Wells lived, down the road from where today Deep Mind is. Another story. We have to begin to look at connections. We have to begin to look at the reality of the phenomenon that we're facing, as opposed to having some old compartments, and then also in relation to. It's legitimate with public figures to say, well, what are you, you know, if you're naive on issues, shut your mouth then. Let's be clear about it. If you're an influential person and you don't know about what you're talking about, maybe you should keep quiet on it. But some of these players are actually advocating what is essentially a political position. It doesn't look like
politics. Yeah, I mean, I think we're essentially on the same page. I just
you're very nice, Tom. I'm very nice too, but sometimes you have to.
I think the problem is that there is just an incredible. There is a problem of cosmic thoughtlessness. My personal experience with many people is it's not that they can't think through it. It's just that they haven't thought through it. And so they just aren't making connections. Just how perfidious our reliance on certain technological, like this, you know, I don't want to just fetishize ChatGPT because it's just one software thing.
Yeah.
Okay. But I see people using it all over the place and they're all excited about it. And I mean, do you not? I had an associate at work who was using it to generate ad statements to give to the customers. And she wasn't putting it together that using this kind of software is fundamentally undermining human culture by giving the exercise of your intelligence and faculty away to a statistically recursive algorithm. And it is not a trivial thing. It is not a banal thing, right? When you use that kind of technology, in my view, you are doing a deep disservice to human beings. And that's just an example. As far as I'm concerned, virtually all so-called AI technology can be thrown out the window because however you can produce, or like Grammarly, I see all these ads for Grammarly. Oh, you know, this will write your email for you. You're giving your power away. You're not even giving your power away to another person. You're giving your power away to a bloody machine that is absent sentience. And you don't see how that's damaging, but most people, as far as I can tell, just haven't made that connection. And so with a kind of naivete are just, you know, going merrily along with their, you know, participation in this absolute disaster. As far as I'm concerned, it's a bloody catastrophe. I mean, people make fun of me because I get kind of militant about it. Don't talk about AI, Tom's here, right? Okay, but it's not even intelligence, all right? But you know, so I'm just wishing that people think more, like draw these connections, and then make the decision that you're not going to participate in these modalities. And yes, that will sometimes produce severe inconveniences. Even hardships. As far as I'm concerned, that's a small price to pay for retaining the prospect of human civilization. That's me. I'm going to step off my
soapbox. Well, the lock is in on many of these things. You're not going to have a choice shortly, Tom, in relation to cash and things like that. The choice will be taken away from you. It's not going to be a human choice, and we're going to be more and more committed. The question is to at what stage will we be able to pull out of the nosedive, which is starting, because it is a massive nosedive for humanity. And that's why it's important to begin to take figures on the edge and say, well, look, for me, it is. If you're saying you think Christopher Hitchens is wonderful and all that, are you really sure you know what the man is saying? Are you really sure you know what his world is like? That the world that they create, or if you're when you're listening to Deepak Chopra or something, do you really understand what the man is saying to you, or what the consequences of this viewpoint is? And I do have a lot of debates, and I've had a lot of debates with my friends in America about, and you know, they tell me about certain people, and I have to say to them, do you know what this man or woman is saying? Do you realize what they're saying? Another figure, for example, which is a classic. These are the figures that are kind of tipping point figures, that your view on them, that they're in between, and your view on them can really say a lot. Teilhard de Chardin is another great figure, because a lot of people hear one thing from what he's saying. I hear a completely different story from him. He's not, I don't believe he's saying what they think he's saying. So you start off your channel talking about pedagogy and about you know, how we learn and about the importance. What I'm saying is that we really have to learn how we're thinking in a new world. This is what I argued for. My main argument in relation to knowledge when I was in the academy was about the need for pragmatic cosmopolitanism. Nobody was interested. Nobody understood it, and they didn't, you know, think it was relevant. It had a kind of zero influence, I'd say. But that's, I was trying to anticipate on the basis of classic pragmatism and an idea of cosmopolitanism, a mode of knowledge that would help you to understand the world when we were no longer living in a fixed world, in a very dynamic, globalized world, that you have to think differently. And when we're thinking differently, we have to look at certain marginal points, people, whatever, and interpret what they're actually saying. You know, did your viewpoint, say, for example, on Jordan Peterson, anticipate what his actual view was when you know, in relation to when hostilities break out? Did you know that he was going to, you know, before, if you go back a bit, would his viewpoint, as articulated, have led you to predict that his viewpoint would be this thing? You know, so this is kind of important. I'm arguing for not a scientific approach, but some kind of intellectually testable approach in your own head, a hypothesis that you can begin to interpret what's out there again, not looking for some cosmic faultlessness, not looking for some political correctness, but just some orientation. There's the pole star up there. Let's orientate ourselves by that. What is the thing? And it's so difficult for people that what I'm saying is that you have to begin to develop some hypothesis, some, in order to interpret the world, that we can't stay out of this. We might not be interested in war and the world, but the war is interested in us. The world is interested in us. Mm-hmm. It's coming to your doorstep. You can't not have a view on it.
Right. Yeah, important. Well, today, de Chardin, he's an instructive figure, because there's lots of things which, you know, he says that sound very like, oh, that's very nice, right? But the problem is that he kind of technologizes things which aren't amenable to being technological. There's a very, you know, it's love is not a science. And if you, and I think that, you know, with Teilhard de Chardin, I don't think he really understood what he was, the implications of his position, to be perfectly honest, right? Because what he's doing is he's domesticating elements of human experience which are utterly radical. In my reading, he, whenever you have this sort of progressive notion of history, which is what he's trying to install, paradoxically, you are undermining the Christianity which you're invoking to ground that. Because what you're doing is you're trying to take something out of the hands of the divine and put it into a formula. And in some respects, it's a subtle move, but it's a move that is deeply problematic, because it plays directly into the hands of people who are interested in control and not freedom. And control is really antithetical to love, as I stand.
I think he was a transhumanist, post-humanist. He had no real interest. Personally, I don't think he had any real interest in any orthodox view of Christianity. I can't find it. And his views are utterly consistent with an extreme form of collective consciousness and materialization where the human is technologically fit into a collective system. And he was, of course, very close to Julian Huxley and others. But we can talk about that again. I can't see any good reading of it in my view. And you use the word freedom, which is important. I'm not going to come back to that to explain where I think the different notions of freedom are at last point. But another figure which is on the margin for me is Terence McKenna. Anytime I criticize Terence McKenna, I get loads of people, you know, a lot of people, oh, you don't understand, or he didn't say that, he didn't mean this. There's something remarkable about him that people don't actually listen to what the man is saying or don't familiarize themselves sufficiently with the range of his work. And he's not saying what I think or what I think he's saying, or we have a difference. And I'm only using what the man said with respect to what he said about again, another transhumanist perspective about prosthesis, the information age, changing to human, evolving to human, merging with the machine.
I'm not really very familiar with him. So, sorry.
Well, the essay I point to, I think it's 1999, is Psychedelics in the Information Age, a short essay, but that is an important statement of his position. I think that's the name of it. Or Psychedelics in the Age of Information, something like that. And read that and see what you think of it. To me, it's consistent with a transhumanist view. That's what I read in it when I read his essay, what he has said. But the last point about... Sorry?
Go on.
The last point about freedom and what is freedom. There are differences. And this will be the difference. Because in both cases, on the left and the right, they're both characterized by governance, by elites, despite what they say. But the movement towards this paradise is by an elite group of people in both cases. They share that oligarchical, concentrated viewpoint, whatever way you look at it. And there was a series at the moment, and I think it was on BBC, about Jimmy Savile, who was a notorious sex abuser, DJ, television personality, protected by the establishment, never prosecuted in his life, huge amount of terrible things that he did. And he did an interview with a man that I met, a psychiatrist, a famous kind of television psychiatrist as well, called Professor Anthony Clare, who was a very intelligent man, very astute man. He was one of the few individuals that said there's something wrong with this man in a public context. After he interviewed him, he said there's something chilling about this apparent saint. Now, this is the same idea we talked about being able to interpret what we're looking at. But he perceived it, as did Johnny Rotten, the Sex Pistols. He said he was barred from the BBC after he said it early on. He said this man is not what you believe him to be. But in the course of that interview with Professor Anthony Clare, this guy, this psychopath, whatever way you want to, whatever, he said, what you ordinary people don't understand is that you're not able to manage freedom because I have ultimate freedom. And a lot of you people wouldn't be. He said something, words to that effect. So freedom for a certain type of people, and particularly in elites, is the freedom to do what you want. It's the license to do what you want. That's what the freedom is. It's to do things without restraint, without any control, without control of the consequence of risk, in a kind of Promethean way where you don't have to consider the risk. This is what freedom is. So the freedom that certain groups are talking about are freedom for particular classes of people, people that are in on the game, people that are in the charmed circle. And Martin Amis wrote about the zone of interest, about Auschwitz and the Nazis that lived around. So the zone of interest was the place they existed in, independent of the horror they were working in, the same as the dachas in Stalinist Soviet Union. So elites create places for themselves to live, and they have this idea of freedom, as opposed to the idea that individuals have an inherent freedom in them, that's given to them by nature, by God, by their own disposition, whatever way you want to base it, that they're inherently free, and that any impediment on that has to be justified by some common interest that is legitimate, proportionate, etc. So that's the starting point for me about the freedom of the individual. This is not the freedom that we're going to get in this context. The freedom will be for the groups that control the technological system to do what they want without restraint, without having to call on a God that they don't believe in or a higher force or whatever. This is what they have told us. This is what Bernal has said in his book, The World of Flesh and the Devil. This is what all if you look at a lot of the scientists in Britain in the 20s, 30s, they were all Stalinist or communist or whatever. The view, the scientific worldview and communism was very close together. So as against the view that the left has declined, that the left has gone missing, I say that's wrong. I say that we're facing a new iteration of a new militant materialism that can combine communism and the elements of corporatism, fascism, in one. This is what scientism, this is the danger of scientism. This is the pincer movement of the left and right. And in that context, some of the people that you think are on your side are articulating the viewpoint which promotes that. So you have to be very careful, in my view, and you have to really look at and question people that seem to be saying things that are nice, that seem to be on your side, that seem to be arguing for a certain type of freedom, and question some of the fundamental things. Does this actually promote freedom? Is this really something which in the long haul or in the short term is actually promoting freedom? Is this military action in some strange country actually promoting anybody's freedom? And in most cases, they don't. So it does come to a point about, as you talk about in your introduction to the channel, about understanding a way of learning about the world, and we do really have to reassess our position and throw out some of the dichotomies that don't exist in the same way, or at least understand them in a broadened way. And that's what the cosmopolitanized view is. And with a pragmatic view, the idea that you look at things, not the later stuff of Rorty and all that, but the earlier stuff, just simple perspective, looking at things from a different perspective, looking at a range of views, considering them, and asking yourself, well, what's the effect of this view? What's this geared towards? What's its purpose, etc.? As a simple proposition, is a useful way that we have to engage, as opposed to accepting whether we think a person is nice, or whether we think they're, you know, harmless or naive or whatever. We have to be really say, well, actually, this viewpoint, and help them if we think, and help say, well, actually, this viewpoint has different consequences. Now, they don't have to listen to us, but some people might. We have to. There has to be a persuasion, an advocacy, an effort to make a case, a robust case, in a non, and hopefully in a reasonable way, to say, look, you can look at it from this perspective. Does that perspective change your viewpoint on the world? If you look at it from this angle and the consequences, would that change how you approach technology, how you are embracing of everything, of the system, for example, how you engage? It might do, if we begin to understand how we're being encapsulated. Another word I use is we're being immured, an immure mentalization process. We're being encapsulated in technology. We're being integrated, and we're going to enter a phase of endosymbiosis, where the technology comes into our body. We won't be able to escape it. So I'm saying, if we understand what the origin is, we can understand what the destination is, and it may help people interpret what it is. If a hypothesis is presented which is robust, consistent, evidenced, can be supported by reasonable sources, and the argument is presented, people can judge for themselves if they're so disposed to, or accept the consequences of their lack of interest.
I think that's perhaps a good place to sort of leave it for the day. But maybe we can have another one where you we start with this notion of pragmatic cosmopolitanism and unpack it. So, but thank you as always, James. So is there anything else before we sign off here?
No, we'll do that. Yeah, the pragmatic cosmopolitanism. I was an abandoned vehicle after I realized that nobody was listening to it. If there's any utility in the concept still, it may be worth exploring merely as a method of knowledge. So certainly we could do that. Thanks for the conversation as always, Thomas. And good luck with your work. And I appreciate the range of different views. And I enjoy the range of different views. And it's only through examining the range of different views and different emphasis that we can get the nuances out, and that will help us to see the contrasts or not. Thanks.
So have a good night.
Same to you, Thomas. Good luck.
Bye.